My guest today began his radio career in 1951. Ron Robinson from Victoria. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you, Mike.
I understand you're here to pick up an award tonight.
Well, as a matter of fact, 50 years after the fact, I'm getting recognized for something that seems so out of date from a previous technology. We were reconstructing baseball games, the away games we couldn't afford to send our broadcaster on the road. And so Western Union supplied a play-by-play account over the wire. It came in like a teletype. We saw it on a teletype machine. From that very sketchy outline of the game, we were able to put together a pretty accurate picture of what was happening in, say, Salt Lake City or Sacramento. Or in the early days, we actually were in San Francisco and Los Angeles with the Pacific Coast League. That was before the big league teams came west. Anyway, we got into the reconstructing of baseball in 1956 when the Vancouver Mounties joined the Coast League. I had a fascination with the idea of the reconstruction from the fact that back in the late 40s and early 50s, Gordon McClendon had the Liberty Broadcasting System out of Dallas, Texas. And from Dallas and the studios there, he and a guy by the name of Wes Wise and Lindsey Nelson and a couple of other chaps, Jerry Doggett was one of them, they reconstructed the big league ball games from back east with a most elaborate sound effect system. I couldn't imagine exactly how it was done, and I tried to piece it together and make it as realistic as possible using sound effects that we recorded at what was then Capilano Stadium, now Nat Bailey. We were able, even in the days of soft cut acetates, 33 and a third, we were doing some of our crack of the bats off those kinds of cuts, which I had to renew every couple of weeks. Then we have gradually evolved into using Botmaster tape machines, cartridge tapes, could get the recordings to repeat from that kind of equipment. And obviously they didn't wear out with the frequency that the soft cut acetates did. Anyway, we got the crack of the bat. It wasn't the case of so many people who did reconstructions in those days used a pencil and some kind of a soft wood item to hit. They would actually physically hit it, and that would be the crack of the bat. Well, we actually had the sound of the bat, sometimes a foul ball, sometimes a line drive, and we tried to make the sound as appropriate as possible from these recordings that we'd made right here in Vancouver. Then we had, what did we add? We added a PA system. That was what I thought was lacking in most reconstructions that I heard. The fact that you didn't hear the PA announcer, which is part of every broadcast that you normally hear. And so we had an echo machine, and I on the control board would be the PA announcer. And from time to time in different ballparks, we added organ music and that sort of thing. We made it as realistic as possible, even to the point that when there was a technical breakdown and we weren't getting the material to make the broadcast out of, we would actually pull the patch cord out of our board, and the announcer on the main board would cut in and say something like, "One moment, please," and play some music until we reestablished contact. That was the kind of thing we did. Of course, there was an ethical line that we never crossed, and Jim Robson, Bill Stevenson, any of our broadcasters never actually said they were there at the park. We just painted the picture as if we were, because it wouldn't be right to say that you're calling the game as if you were sitting at the park. So I don't know what the difference was, but we never said here in Salt Lake City.
You were the six-armed paper hanger that was running the effects and doing the stadium announcing.
Yeah, we did. In the first instance, I didn't have anything to do on the air because we had two people doing the play-by-play. Then as Bill Stevenson left us and Jim Robson took over the main job, I think we did have a secondary announcer come in and help Jim on one season. Then Jim was left to do the play-by-play himself for the entire nine innings, and that's when I started doing commercials, scores in between innings, as well as the PA announcing on the echo machine.
So this was pretty creative broadcasting.
Well, we tried to make it so. It was in a different era, a different technology. Today it would be so much simpler. And I think, you know, if I just had the equipment that they use today to do those broadcasts way back when, it would have been a cinch.
You are being inducted to the Vancouver Canadiens Baseball Club Broadcast and Journalism Hall of Fame tonight.
Well, I think that's due to my friend Jim Robson. I think he probably went to bat for me, if you'll pardon that expression. But anyway, I think he pushed the fact that he always thought that my contribution went comparatively unrecognized. He lobbied for me, and that's what happened. They decided I would get recognized, and tonight is the night.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Ahead of your award. Let's go back to the very beginning, 1951. How old were you then, and how did you get your foot in the door?
It actually, how old was I? In 51, I would have been 18. I'd been at UBC already for a couple of years. I started there when I was 16, and I actually went through one whole year at UBC without any connection with radio. I hadn't yet stumbled down the stairs of the Brock Hall into the Radio Society area. I had pretty good marks that first year. And then year two came around, and I was enrolled in commerce. I decided that engineering really wasn't for me. At the end of the first year of arts, you had to opt for what you were going to specialize in. Instead of engineering, which had been my plan all along, I went into commerce because, well, I thought it had business possibilities that I really never did exploit. But my folks wanted me to have something to fall back on even after I caught the radio bug, even after I was at Rad Sox 6 and 8 hours a day, even after I started taking this course that CKW UX was giving under Johnny Ansel and Laurie Irvin, and I think Rio Thompson had his hand in the start of it too. Rio Thompson was a great idol of mine that has not received enough recognition in Canadian broadcasting for my money. He was a very, very talented guy. Anyway, the idea was that they were going to give people from the university, mostly from the Radio Society, I think we're all members of the Radio Society, they were going to give us some basic training in broadcasting. We went weekly for Tuesday night sessions at the CKWX Playhouse, 543 Seymour Street, and learned and had practicums, actually made some broadcasts onto tape, I think it was in those days. And the carrot on the stick was, at the end of the first year, the person who comes up in first place will get a job at CKWX doing some part-time relieving work. Well, it turned out that I don't know if there was any manipulation or what it was, but I got to be that person. And I started doing some weekend relief and some summer relief in March of 1951.
Were you actually on air playing discs, doing shows, doing news?
I was on Saturday and Sunday nights. For a lot of that time, I was it. There was other talent coming in, people coming in to do shows. We had Evan Kemp's Trail Riders in our facility in the Playhouse. They did a show from 8:15 to 9 o'clock. I had done the news from 8 to 8:15, and before that, from 7:30 to 8, I had done a Sagebrush Serenade show, which I guess was tied in with the Evan Kemp approach to music, country style. The rest of the schedule, I'm a little bit hazy on 50-some-odd years later, but I remember my shift ran from 5 until 1 a.m., and the station signed off at 1 a.m. There was a 1 o'clock news, then we turned off the lights.
Who were some of the people who were working there that helped you along the way to get your career underway?
Well, let's talk about some of the people that I remember so fondly. Jack Kyle was there. Eric G. was there. Eric was not what I would call a very talented broadcaster, but he was a guy who knew how everything worked. He was a journeyman broadcaster who could fill any shift, but wasn't going to be a star. Rio Thompson was a great talent and a real person to emulate if you could. Cal George was there. Bob Hutton was there. Vern Groves was there as Bob White, the answer man. Johnny Ansel was program director. Laurie Irvin was production director. And a guy I have to mention, because I don't want his name to be forgotten, was Fred Bass. Fred Bass was one of the pioneers of CKWX. I think he'd probably joined the station in the 20s, the late 20s, and had been with them all through the 30s when things were a little bit desperate until Taylor Pearson and Carson came along, I think in 1940, 41, and turned it into an excellent operation.
So after your initial shifting there, what happened next?
I was there for 17 years. I was there till 1968. I had risen to the position of assistant program director John Ansel was the PD. I had been his assistant for a good chunk of time, and an opening came up in Victoria, and I was offered the job of being program director at CJVI. I gladly accepted. I uprooted the family, and we moved over to Victoria, and that was probably a life-changing experience because Victoria became a place that I would probably pay a price not to have to leave. Victoria just had everything that I really liked in a city. It was a big city with few of the big city problems, at least at that time. It is a very desirable place to live, as witness the way the real estate prices have escalated over the decades.
You spent quite a few years at CJVI, well, from, I believe, 68 to 73?
Correct.
And then you moved on over to CKDA and CFMS.
Well, I guess I had my first real problem in broadcasting, and that was as program director in 1973. There was a big shift in Selkirk at the time, and they were moving people all around from Edmonton to Lethbridge, Calgary, Vancouver. There was a big shift of secondary management, as we were, from one station to another, and there wasn't a spot for me. And part of that was because I had run into personal problems of romantic nature involving a fellow staff member at CJVI, and my first marriage came to a crashing end, and so did my executive radio career.
Then you went to CKDA and CKMS, and that was until 1995.
Well, yes. I got into private business, small business in Victoria, and that was my basic effort for about 10 years. At the same time, I was drawn back into broadcasting from an on-air perspective. No longer did I really have any taste for climbing the corporate ladder, but I was quite happy to help out on weekends, help out on problems where the station had a hole that needed filling, and I was adequate as an on-air performer. Still was on the disc jockey side of things, doing morning radio on the weekends, then go to the shop for 6 hours, then, as a matter of fact, I was on Saturdays doing another 6 hours at Western Speedway announcing the car races. So Saturdays were a long day, and I was younger at the time, and I had the energy to do it. Today, I don't think I could handle two of those jobs. But it was at that time that it was about 1982 that I first got involved in news. And news was the thing, Mike, that saved me as far as my enthusiasm for radio was concerned. By the time I was in my 50s, I no longer had much relevance with the current music of the day. It was really exciting to be able to find a new challenge in the news side of things that really occupied the last years of my broadcasting career. I guess the last, 20 years anyway. I was on the news side, and I was first at CFMS doing morning breakfast news, and then laterally at CKXM, which was the country station that The Q put on the air in 1995 as a replacement for CKDA.
And you stayed there until 2001.
I did.
Were you doing news there as well?
I was doing news throughout that time, and I was pretty good at it. Radio stations have found that playing the same music over and over again, or at least playing the same selections till the staff are absolutely fed up with it, is the way to attract a big audience for that kind of music. Of course, the listener doesn't have the chance to hear it as often as the broadcaster does, and therefore it doesn't seem like you're hearing the same music every hour of every day.
What, during your entire career, what would be probably your favorite moment, a highlight?
Oh boy. I guess the excitement of setting up the baseball reconstructions and getting that whole end of things organized, because that was my baby and I had to decide exactly how much could I continue to do every day, every night, how much will be effective, how much effort will be not so effective, how many different things can I juggle and still make work effectively and have the announcers' cooperation on it. One thing that I added to the broadcast as time went along was the sound of the ball going into the catcher's mitt. That was something that I felt on pitches where there was no contact with the bat, that you were expecting to hear it hit the catcher's mitt unless you had an awfully big crowd. So we set it up so the announcer, in this case Jim Robson, was able to hit the button and get the glove in the get the ball in the glove at the right time. For the crack of the bat, he had to signal me. He would fire a finger at me, and that would be the cue to let the pitch come in. So I think we had a pretty all-round good representative reconstructed broadcast, if that isn't too much of a phrase.
Interesting people you met outside of the business during your time in news. Anyone special that you interviewed and thought was a great interview?
Well, let's see. I did a lot of showbiz interviews in the 60s. I had interviews with Pat Boone, with Petula Clark, with Frankie Lane, people from a bygone era. Teresa Brewer was one of them. I talked to a very funny guy by the name of Sandy Barron, who isn't thought of today very highly, but I was a real fan of his back then. He was one of the many acts that came to the Cave and therefore were looking for publicity and therefore were happy to appear on CKWX as part of our afternoon show. I got to interview a lot of pretty good, next to top name personalities who were in the show business at that time. Frankie Lane would be one of the best of them. I'm trying to think of somebody who was difficult. Petula Clark was not an Brenda Lee was another one who was a sweetheart to talk to. She was really kind to me and very friendly. Petula Clark had a little bit of British standoffishness, I would say.
You mentioned some people that you thought should be given some publicity, the people who basically are not well remembered. There must be some other names that you'd like to mention.
Well, I worked with some really nice people at CKWX. Norris McLean was one of them. He passed on earlier this year. Cal George was a great guy, really a pleasant person to be with. Oh, let's see, Don Fawcett was, I think Ross Crane talked about him and the end of Bill Ward's career at CKWX.
Any, shall we say, funny or embarrassing stories?
I did have a couple of interesting commercial faux pas that I remember to this day. And I remember back when I was just getting started in the business and I'd been out for an evening with friends. I had a girl with me, I remember, and another couple. And I decided, you know, I'd like to show off this fancy place that I worked at. So we went up there just close to midnight. At midnight, the station had a Bull of a Watch commercial, had a time check followed by a 60-second written spot. And then you went into a five-minute newscast. And I thought, well, change of voice was a big deal in those days. You didn't do a lot of live stuff back-to-back if you could avoid it. Usually in the daytime, there were more than two people around and somebody could pop in and do it for you. And that was usually part of the broadcast business. You didn't want to have one person doing everything if you could avoid it. So I decided I would volunteer to do this midnight commercial for Boulevard. Well, I didn't realize just how much partying I'd been doing that evening, and my mouth just wouldn't work right. I don't know how bad it sounded on the air, but in my head, I was not doing a good job at all, and the words were getting all mixed up, and they were just not being done professionally, and I decided I was never going to do that again.
Did anybody record that
nobody
you know
recorded
of?
It. It was gone forever. It was back before the days of the 24-hour logging machine, which so many good things came out of in the future, but back in those days we weren't doing it. The other one I remember was not quite the same, but similar to it. We were doing a lot of advertising for ShopEasy, for Super Value, and for Safeway. And I remember doing a spot at 12:59 p.m. on CKWX, coming up to the start of the 1 o'clock news. It was a spot for Super Value that I ended up with Shop and Save at Safeway. Not Shop and Save at Super Value, Shop and Save at Safeway. How do you change that? How do you correct that at that precise moment when the beep's going to go and it's 1 o'clock? There's just no way of doing it. And I had a red face for a month after that.
Do you still listen to radio?
I do, but I don't listen to contemporary radio to speak of. I have quite a collection of radio before your time, I'm sure, from the so-called call old-time radio days, the shows that I grew up with and which made me fall in love with radio, I aspired to be part of that without realizing that I could ever do it. At the time, we were listening to Los Angeles, Hollywood, we were listening to New York, we were listening to Toronto in Canada, and it just didn't seem possible that I would ever have what it took to go on the air and make these strange sounds and make a career out of it. So I had really given up by the time I got out of high school and into university. I really didn't think it was going to happen at all until I got into the UBC Radio Society, and it was actually able to put my hands on the equipment and open the mic and do some testing that way and figuring out what it was that I was good at.
Were they still doing radio drama at RadSock back then?
Not so much. Radio drama was in the era before us. Eric Nickel was a great writer for the CBC and had grown up at UBC Radio, or at RadSock as we called it in those days. Eric Nickel, the scripts were still there. There was a lot of evidence of drama that was the tradition of the Radio Society, but we were into the era of the personality disc jockey. In the 50s we had Seattle, we had Gil Henry was a marvelous disc jockey on King AM 1090. There were a couple of other remarkable local people we could identify with as somebody that could make sounds on the radio that were just as entertaining as these scripted old shows that we were listening to in the decade before that.
Favorite shows from that era?
Oh, favorite shows. I think Phil Harris' Alice Faye Show is probably my favorite from those days. I also was a big fan, the family was a big fan of the Lux Radio Theater. It rolled into British Columbia at 6 o'clock in the evening. And I know we spent many a Monday night gathered around the dinner table listening to the Lux Radio Theater. It was just that good stuff. And in those days, movies had more of an aura of wow than they do today.
The writing and the performances were fabulous.
Well, we got to hear a lot of the stars in their original roles, and a lot of times there were really big names who came in to fill the part on radio because that particular actor or actress didn't really want to do radio. Was the microphone kind of threatened them somehow. And we heard some, I think perhaps with the Lux Radio Theater, it was Cecil B. DeMille and his very distinctive way of speaking and his authoritarian stand or stance, his performance that intrigued me most about that show. It usually was a case of somebody hooked you with their personality or their approach to material. You just made a habit of tuning in every week. And it's amazing how much more you can do with the theater of the mind than you ever will do with taking it in from a television. There's a group in Seattle that we make a point of attending every June when they put on their showcase. Radio enthusiasts of Puget Sound have been in business for, 25 years or more. The last 3 or 4 years, we've made a point of going down. They used to be able to get a lot of the old original stars of the radio performance to come up and do their actual original roles. Now those people are few and far between. We still are able to see Shirley Mitchell. Shirley Mitchell's 90 now, and she still comes up and does a remarkable Lela Ransom. If anybody's ever heard the old Great Gildersleeve shows, Lela Ransom was just, well, for me as a teenager, she was my ideal romantic notion, if you will. She just was so Southern and so sexy.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add to this little chunk of history we're creating here?
Well, I'm really appreciating what you're doing, Mike, the fact that you have recorded such people as Ross Crane. Ross is the one interview that you've done that I sat and listened to every moment of. I'm glad that these are going into some kind of a repository where people will be able to hear what radio was like in the old days.
I'd like to once again, before we close this off, congratulate you on the award that you are getting tonight for those baseball recreations. And also, you are a member of the Half Century Club of the CAB as well.
Yeah, that's true. I survived it for 50 years. I decided I didn't actually leave the job. The job left me when CKXM went off the air as a country station and became something modern rock in terms of the zone now, CKXM needed a news presence. The station figured for the zone format, they didn't. So a newscaster was no longer required. So that's when I decided to, rather than try to extend my career any longer, I'd had 50 excellent years. That was time to hang it up. There's too much work being done by the computer, and there's too much work being done by people who are having to do two or three shows in perhaps two or three cities. Computer is a wonderful device as long as it's something that is an adjunct to the human personality.
Ron Robinson, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today and adding to this little archive of history.
Thank you, Mike.